Hi there, welcome to this AAT podcast on the payroll year end and potential PAYE and NIC failures. Going to look at potential failures, changes affecting the year end, and some changes affecting the start of next tax year, 2008-09. So looking ahead, P11D is the deadline, 6th of July 2008. But of course, by the time we get to that deadline, the payroll's closed down. So are there any expenses or benefits that attract Class 1 National Insurance, the P11D blue boxes, as opposed to Class 1A National Insurance, which is due on most benefits, and fits into the brown boxes on the P11D? The Class 1A is payable on the 19th of July. But if there's any Class 1 due, it has to be paid by the 19th of April. And the blue box might mean Class 1, referring to the payment of an employee liability. And my guidance to you on this is always remember to check Appendix 1 of the CWG5 booklet, HMRC's booklet, the golden guide to helping you decide, is it P11D or is it PAYE? Now I want to look at some potential PAYE failures. We start with the payroll. Do we have any students paid without deducting tax under the P38S procedure? Should they have used the P38S procedure? Was the work done in the holiday time when it would apply, or in the term time when it wouldn't apply? Do you need to check that? Are there any other situations where a no tax code has been used for an employer or director? Do you have any evidence to justify that no tax code? Have you got a P6 from HMRC? You need to check that if you're not deducting tax from anyone. Do you have any evidence to justify no national insurance being deducted or reduced national insurance being deducted? Again, the sort of thing to carry out as a end of year check before you start to do the end of year returns. Category X for national insurance means no national insurance, but who would it apply to? A 15-year-old under the age to attract national insurance. Someone coming from abroad, but do they have a certificate of coverage from where they've come from to justify not paying national insurance? Another end of year check for national insurance, directors. Directors have a special basis for paying national insurance. It's called the annual earnings basis. But most directors pay normal NICs. So that means when you get to the end of the year, you've got to check to see, did you deduct enough national insurance from the directors? Do they have any bonuses in the year which might affect the national insurance? Did any director leave during the tax year? Because if they did, the national insurance should have been recalculated and checked. Okay, that's payroll. What about the nominal ledger, the purchases? Do we have any self-employed individuals who really are not self-employed? The other week, I looked at some invoices and I saw an invoice for Mr. A, £1,800 to professional services for 1 month. And the following month, exactly the same, £1,800 to professional services. Well, the question arises, what were the professional services? What were the contractual arrangements? Was Mr. A genuinely self-employed? Something else you might find within the purchases nominal ledger system. Are there any taxable expenses there? Is there a taxi account with Computer Cab or someone like that? Are people having taxis from home to get into work, from work to get to the station to go home at night? I'll talk a little bit more in a minute about late night taxis, but are there taxable taxis going through the purchase system which have to be reported? Are there hotel bills paid direct by the company to the hotel? Are they business hotels? Or was someone staying at a hotel near their normal place of work because they were working late, or perhaps because they were out on the town in the night? potentially a taxable benefit that has to be reported. Then we move on to petty cash, which can be something of a nightmare when it comes to compliance reviews and checking end-of-year returns. Do we have any round sum allowances or per diems that are paid through petty cash, where there's no dispensation? Because any round sum allowance or per diem allowance, for example, when someone's working overseas, has to be covered by a dispensation. Otherwise, the expenditure has to be receipted and detailed to justify the business deduction. And what about non-receipted expenses? HMRC, when they carry out a compliance review, will be looking at directors' and employees' expenses. If they see claims for expenses, £10 per taxi, £10 per car parking, this type of thing, and if it's on a regular basis and there's no receipts, they may challenge this and argue that it's not an expense, but that it's a round sum allowance that should have gone through payroll. Something that probably should have gone through payroll was mobile phone top-ups. Happens all too often. Somebody makes a claim, often through petty cash, £10 a month, £20 a month, £30 a month, just for mobile phone top-ups. If the mobile phone is a company phone, then it may not be taxable, and providing that the top-up receipt can signify, can prove that it's a company mobile phone, it may not be pursued. But if the company is simply making a contribution towards an employee's use of their own mobile phone, a sort of mobile phone top-up, it's going to be liable to tax an NIC. It should go through the payroll, or perhaps into a PAYE settlement agreement. For people working in the London area, Oyster cards. Is an employer paying a top-up on a regular basis for the use of someone's own Oyster card? If the Oyster card is registered and the journeys are recorded and matched to the expense that's claimed, not a problem. But if they're simply claiming £30 a month Oyster top-up, PAYE and NIC will be sought by HMRC. I mentioned mobile phone top-ups. Another point that often crops up is an employer making a contribution towards an employee's home or mobile telephone bill. If the employer pays the whole bill, or perhaps 50% of the bill, HMRC will want income tax and national insurance on the rental element of the personal phone and on the calls, unless they're identified as business calls. So again, a potential failure which perhaps ought to be adjusted for the PAY or P11D returns. In expenses, again, expenses are going to be reviewed. Cash reimbursement for home-to-work travel will be regarded as a payroll item, pay as you earn, and national insurance. If it's a personal item, like home-to-work travel, if it's cash reimbursement, and indeed cash reimbursement for other personal expenses are going to be sought, pay as you earn national insurance, perhaps a P11D benefit in kind, if the reimbursement is done through a company account. Another major potential pay-as-you-earn failure that needs to be considered at this time of year, before the payroll year-end returns are finalised, is have there been any tax-free termination payments? Termination payments come under different headings. Compensation for loss of office, redundancy payments, payments in lieu of notice, ex gratia payments, payments in commutation of pension rights. You might say, what's in a name? But to start with, you have to say that you cannot assume that the first £30,000 is exempt every time. Contractual payments are liable to tax, and their earnings for NIC's purposes, they're taxable within Section 62. They're not within the exemption provisions of Section 401. If they come within the exemption provisions, the tax limit is £30,000. If they're non-contractual, There's no £30,000 limit for NICs, so it could be £130,000, tax-free on £30,000, NICs free on £130,000 if it's a non-contractual payment. Now, in terms of the types of tax repayments, HMRC will always try to tax payments in lieu of notice. Is there a contractual entitlement? Does the contract say that the employer will make a payment in lieu of notice? If it does, it's liable to tax an NIC. It should be on the payroll. If the contract only provides for a period of notice, HMRC may still argue that the payment is an emolument if the employer habitually or perhaps always makes a payment in lieu of notice, so that perhaps the employee could sue for non-payment. But that's something that you need to take advice on. If a restricted covenant payment was made during the year, it's fully liable to tax and NIC. So the mistake that could arise is that someone receives a non-contractual genuine compensation or redundancy payment and it's less than £30,000. But if included in the amount they receive is, say, £1,000 to cover the restricted covenant within the contract, that £1,000 is fully liable to tax and NIC, irrespective of whether they received more than £30,000 or not. Garden leave payments. If someone is told, because they've resigned, go home, go on garden leave, we will continue to pay you, that is fully liable to pay as you earn and national insurance. The Delaney versus Richardson case was the case in point, the guidance from the courts. Do we need to review the leave and payments made this year? Were there any paid tax-free? Should tax have been deducted? Were there any payments made in excess of £30,000 where tax should have been deducted on the excess? Perhaps at the basic rate if the payment was made after the date of leaving. Was that tax deducted? Was it paid over to HM Revenue and Customs? Those are the sort of payroll year-end checks that we need to make before we close the payroll down, before we do the end-of-year returns. Casual labour. Mentioned it already in passing. But the key point to remember is the minimum reporting requirement is the employee's name, address, and the wages paid in each pay period. It is unacceptable to pay petty cash, for example, to strangers. And this is so often an error that is made. A petty cash slip that says chef cover. A petty cash slip that says payment to driver. A petty cash slip that says cleaner. In terms of satisfying the regulations, in terms of satisfying HMRC, the minimum reporting requirement is the employee name, the address, and the wages paid in each pay period. These payments may have to go on to a P38A employer supplementary return because there hasn't been a P14 going with the P35. You therefore have to have the name and the address, and it should be the real name and the real address. Another point. With casual labour, it's often confused with self-employed. Highly unlikely that HMRC would accept such an excuse. Is it casual labour? Is it self-employed? If it's supposed to be self-employed, will it stack up as being genuinely self-employed? Window cleaners, generally accepted as self-employed. Other cleaners, not accepted. Regulations say they're employed earners, unless, of course, it's a cleaning company, a cleaning business. In the construction industry, contractors often confuse casual labour and self-employed subcontractors. contractor has a site somewhere. He needs some more help. Goes to the local pub, and he offers some work to a couple of people. They have to have the information to enable the contractor to verify them. And if they don't match, they have to have tax deducted at 30%. But are they casual labour? Should they be going through the payroll? Okay, not such a serious matter, but again, potentially a failure in terms of the end of year returns. A pay-as-you-earn failure if it's a cash reimbursement, but a P11D failure if it's on an account. And now I'm going to talk about late night taxis. I mentioned taxis already as a potential failure through the company cab account. People using a taxi to go home after work, to go to the station to get the train home after work. Well, there is an exemption for late night taxis. An exemption within section 248 of ITPA 2003. Exemption from liability if the transport is from work to home. It's not from home to work. Someone may have to have a taxi to come into the restaurant or the hotel or the cafe early in the morning because there's no public transport. But it's taxable because there's no exemption for such travel. The only exemption for coming into work is either for a severely disabled person or if there's public transport disruption. In order to have tax relief exemption from being taxed on late night taxis, there are certain late working conditions that have to be met, and the limit is 60 times a year. The working conditions are required to work late, and that means later than usual, until at least 9 p.m. in the evening, the 9 o'clock watershed. If they are contracted to work late and normally work late, it doesn't apply. They are required to work later than they normally work. Another condition is it must be irregular. And the revenue says that means irregular. It doesn't mean infrequent. The revenue says that public transport must have either ceased or it would be unreasonable at that time of night to use public transport. The revenue have issued new guidance on this in their Employment Income Manual at 21831, that's EIM 21831. It's worth having a look at it, but the key thing is there's a new insistence on record keeping and on management checks by the employer. Would the checks by the employer find that there is no evidence to say the conditions are met? If the conditions are not met, the tax exemption doesn't apply. So do we have anything that we have to report on the P11Ds or to put through the payroll as a cash reimbursement for 2007-08? That's late night taxis. Change going forward to tell you about car benefit changes. The car fuel benefit multiplier, that notional figure on which the car fuel benefit is based, is increasing for next year from £14,400 to £16,900. There's going to be a new 10% band from next year, from 2008-09, for company cars with a CO2 emissions up to and including exactly 120 grams per kilometre. They're called qualifying low emission cars, QALEX. There's no reductions for hybrid or bi-fuel cars, and the 3% diesel charge supplement will still apply, so that if you've got a diesel car that's less than 120 grams per kilometre or less, and let's say it falls into the band, it's 10%, but as a diesel car, it's 10% plus the 3% supplement, 13%. As a petrol car, it will be 10%, providing its CO2s do not exceed 120. There's a new 2% reduction for cars running on E85 fuel, a mixture of 85% bioethanol and 15% unleaded petrol. And there's a new letter G on Form's P46 car and the P11D. Now, something else that was going to be a reporting issue for 2007-08 until HMRC was persuaded to change its mind, and this is medical checkups. Health screening medical checkups. Previously, the guidance from HMRC said, do not treat expenses incurred by the employer in providing periodic medical checkups for employees. Do not treat it as conferring a chargeable benefit on those employees. There was a long-standing practice, effectively a non-statutory concession, which says that you don't tax that if it was available to, say, senior staff, managers and above, people over 50, that type of thing, not taxable. But they basically changed the law, brought it within Section 210 of ITPA, the power to exempt minor benefits. But the problem is they've changed the basis. The cost is exempt if the employer provides an employee with up to one health screening and or medical checkup per year, but with the proviso that the health screening is generally available to all employees and the medical checkup is generally available to all employees. That's not all managers. That's not all employees over 50. The new ruling is all employees it must be available to. All employees don't have to have it. All employees don't have to take up the option. But all employees must have the opportunity to do so. There's no requirement that all employees should receive the same screening or checkup, or that the screening checkup should be made available at the same intervals. So you might have well women screening for the ladies on even years and well man checkups for the men in odd years. Health screening is an assessment to identify employees who might be at risk of ill health. Medical checkup is a physical examination of an employee by a health professional. And HMRC is limited to determining the employee's state of health. If the screening or the checkup results in an employee having to have medical treatment, the exemption does not apply to that medical treatment. So if the employer pays for any medical treatment, it will have to be reported as a benefit in kind if the account is between the employer and the medical provider, or if it's reimbursing the employee's doctor's bill, then it's a personal liability. Class 1 NIC, remember. The new exemption actually applies from the 14th of August 2007, so in the middle of the 2007-08 year. But HMRC have now announced that they're not going to collect tax on NICs for 2007-08 on health screening or medical checkups, providing it wouldn't have been taxed on the basis of the previous non-statutory treatment. So no reporting for 2007-08 if it wasn't taxable before. But watch this space, because it's obviously going to be coming a taxable item once they finish consultation with employers. A new reporting requirement. Reporting non-cash benefits after retirement. HMRC issued guidance on the 2nd of July 2007, if you want to look it up. Non-cash benefits, it says, may be taxable like cash. It'll be treated as employment income of the former employees. There is a de minimis figure of £100, so up to £100, not taxable. We could say big deal, couldn't we? They're now going to be called employer-financed retirement benefit schemes. The important thing is for 2007-08, you may have to make a report to HMRC by the 7th of July 2008. That's the reported requirement, 7th of July after the end of the tax year. The report cannot be made on forms P11D or P9Ds. The report has to be made in list form. The report has to be sent separately, and it should be headed Employer Financed Retirement Benefit Scheme, Relevant Benefits. If there is an employer finance retirement benefit scheme tax office, it goes there. If there's not, it should go to the employer's pay-as-you-earn tax office. The details they require, the details to be reported, are the name, address, and national insurance number of the former employee, the nature of the benefit, the amount of the relevant benefit. Now, some good news on this. Items that do not have to be reported for retired employees, and this actually is backdated to the 6th of April 2006, will be continued provision by the former employer of accommodation and certain related expenses. Got a retired, stable lad, allowed to stay in the accommodation, not reportable, not taxable. Welfare counselling, not reportable. Recreational benefits, maybe continued membership of the gym club, not reportable. Annual parties and similar functions costing up to £150. So just as the exemption for annual staff parties for employees, it's extended to former employees. The same rules, the same limit, £150, inclusive of VAT, inclusive of all other costs. Equipment for disabled former employees. So if an employer decides to pay £3,000 for Sir Hearing Aids for a former employee, it wouldn't be taxable. Writing of wills costing up to £150, not reportable, not taxable. HMRC says that benefits where the right to the continuing benefit arose before 6th of April 1998 are not taxable. But this is because there were special rules then that I don't think we need to worry about today. Something else that perhaps will require reporting for 2007-08. Company cars and the fuel reimbursement or recovery. HMRC publishes advisory fuel rates for company cars. And in 2007-08, they've changed three times. February 2007 through to the 31st of July 2007, we had effectively a reduction in the rates from the 1st of February. Then the rates went up on the 1st of August 2007, and then again went up on the 1st of January 2008. These rates may be used as a basis for appeal of any dispensation. But the important thing is, have they been used to recover private fuel from an employee or director, and therefore has sufficient been recovered to cover the full cost of private fuel? What we should all remember is that if an employee or director has just £1 of private fuel and has a company car, the fuel scale charge will arise. Now, some good news. The guidance from HMRC on this is that there may be a pay-as-you-earn a national insurance liability on the excess rate for genuine business mileage. But of course, if the business mileage is a problem, if it's not properly recorded, there could be a car fuel benefit, which means this obviously needs to be monitoring when the changes are taking place. Now, let me give you an example. An employee has a company car with CO2s of 20%. And he has a fuel card. The fuel scale charge for 2007-08 would be £14,400 at 20%. That's £2,880. But the employee can avoid the charge, and then you don't need to report the benefit if he repays the full cost of the private fuel element. The employee would have to record his business mileage and his private mileage to satisfy the employer and perhaps HMRC on a cheque, satisfy them that the full cost of private fuel has been repaid. If proper mileage records were kept throughout the year and payment was made at the advisory fuel rates, there would be no fuel charge. Now, the rates for this car I'm talking about, 1.9 Audi, 10p a mile from the 6th of April to the 31st of July, and then 11p up until the 5th of April. So no fuel scale charge if those rates were used and the full cost was repaid. If records were kept but the reimbursement stayed at 10p a mile, perhaps because the employer didn't know about the change, we would have an overpayment, we'd have an excess. So if we say roughly 5,700 miles at a penny a mile overpaid, because it should have been repaid at 11p from the 1st of August. It was repaid at 10p. The tax liability and the national insurance liability would only be just over £30. So that wouldn't be much of a problem. It could be adjusted. But the problem would be if there were no mileage records kept, or if the mileage records were inadequate, in which case the revenue would insist on recovering the fuel scale charge, £2,880, tax at 40%, £1,152, class 1A of £368.64. And then, of course, if the employer footed the bill, the tax would be grossed up and there would be class 1A on the tax paid as well. So the key thing is, needs to be monitored. Do we have any 2007-08 reporting, because those rates were not changed? Again, a point going forward now, just for reference purposes, there's some changes to residence and domicile rules which may affect some employees and directors. And what it basically says is there's an additional tax charge for any individual using the remittance basis who's been in the UK for at least 7 years. Charge of £30,000 unless their unremitted income or gains are less than £2,000. And the rules on when people are counting their days of arrival and departure in the UK are changing from the 6th of April as well. This may affect tax codings going forward. It may affect tax liability. And from the 6th of April 2008, the days of arrival and departure will not be counted. A very quick example, Thierry lives in Paris. He's sent to work in London for 3 years. He arrives Monday morning, goes home on Friday. Monday's not counted because it's his day of arrival. Friday's not counted, day of departure. He's only in the UK for accounting purposes at the moment, 3 days a week, 135 days a year based on 45 weeks, taking out the holidays. So he's less than 183 days, not UK tax resident, over that three-year period. When the rule changes on the 6th of April, all 5 days will be counted. 5 days times 45 weeks, 225 days, UK tax resident. That could have an impact on his tax coding situation. Now, looking ahead again to 2007-08 P11Ds, I just want to update you on the changes. The form has changed, the date has changed, it's 2007-08. The note to the employee in the top right has been expanded, and the sex box that we had before has been changed to a gender box. So it now says gender, and then you put M for male or F for female. The employee name box is split into two boxes. But the most important change for you to remember going forward, the number boxes on the left-hand side of the cash equivalent boxes have changed to match the self-assessment tax return changes. So we now have box numbers 9 to 16 instead of 1.12 to 1.23. What I ask you to remember is to change the numbers if you're using P11D lists or P11D schedules to submit to HMRC. And guidance on submitting P11Ds in list form is in the booklet 480 at paragraph 25.6. Another quite important change in section F of the P11Ds, company cars and car fuel, the explanatory text beneath dates car was available has been changed this year. It says, do not complete the from box if the car was available on the 5th of April. So if someone had the same car the year before, 2006-07, so 6th of April, start of the 2007-08 tax year, the car that they had the year before, just leave it blank because it's the same car. And do not complete the two box if it continued to be available on the 6th of April. So if someone had the same car throughout the year, 6th of April 2007 to the 5th of April 2008, and they still had it the next day, you don't put anything in those boxes. Leave it blank. Because the computer reading will just assume that the car was there the whole of the time. There were a lot of problems in the last year with tax code changes which were wrong, because these were being misread. So be very aware of that change. Another change on the P11D is there's a new box in section G for van fuel benefit. We now have a £500 company van fuel benefit when any private fuel is provided, but providing the van benefit charge is more than naught. Sounds a little silly, but what it basically means is if there's no company van benefit charge because the only use is from home to work, which is allowed for vans but not for cars, there'll be no fuel benefit. PLMD dispensations. You can't see what I'm reading, but it says, help, I'm confused. And I am a bit confused because the messages from the revenue are very mixed. In the employee bulletin number 27 in October 2007, we had a heading of dispense with the routine, and we had guidance saying, we want to help you reduce the amount of information you need to report, encouraging people to apply for dispensations. Employee bulletin 28 in February 2008 said, watch out in April or May for a dispensation wizard that will tell you if you can apply for a dispensation. So again, another encouragement to apply for dispensations using this new wizard, which we haven't seen yet, of course, and telling us whether you would be able to apply. But then in the same employer bulletin, number 28 in February, there's a heading of news on dispensations and quite a stark warning. It starts off by saying, where we're satisfied there's no liability to income tax or NICs for certain expenses or benefits, a notice of dispensation can be given. But then it goes on to say, we will now consider revoking a dispensation retrospectively where there is any evidence of misrepresentation or negligence by an employer. And it gives us examples. The application didn't provide all the relevant information, or there was a change in the way the expenses and benefits were made available. HMRC was not told of the change. So I'm saying to you, you've been warned. We are still being encouraged to apply for dispensations, but when you're coming to do the PLMDs for 2007-08, are you going to use a dispensation, and is it still valid? Well, that's it for Payroll Year End guidance, really. Just to remind you, Payroll Year End is about filing end-of-year PAYE, NIC and P11D returns, but only after reconciling the payments and deductions made during the year. Therefore, have the correct deductions been made, or do we now have some adjustments to be made to get them correct before we file the returns? Also, remember the deadlines. We start off with the 19th of April payment deadline, which, because that's Saturday, we've got to be thinking of Friday, the 18th of April deadline for paying any pay-as-you-earn, national insurance and indeed CIS deductions that were due for the tax year 2007-08. Statutory deadline for the returns, the 19th of May 2008, to get those returns in and avoid penalties. And then the 19th of July deadline, which again, we have to work around the Saturday, therefore Friday the 18th of July deadline for Class 1A national insurance contributions to be paid. Remembering, of course, that every payment deadline changes to the 22nd of the month if it's electronic payment. So remember the deadlines and set yourself or your clients a realistic timetable to get these end of year returns in, both accurately and on time. Thank you and goodbye.